You're listening to Stealing from Wizards, Volume 2, Burglary, by R.A. Consul. Chapter 15, Self-Guided Tours. Charlie informed Kuro that he was officially allowed to be interesting again during first period social studies of the following day. They were meant to be reading and summarizing a chapter on the history of Avalon Academy, an activity Charlie considered optional since it was stuff everybody knew already, and much less interesting than what Kuro had to say about the burglaries. Kuro wasn't sure who was included in everybody, as he certainly didn't know anything about it. From Marie's grouchy sidelong glance at Charlie, neither did she. Kuro tried for a moment to convince himself to argue. They could talk at lunch, and they should be doing their schoolwork. He knew it was the right thing to say, but he was prevented on several fronts. He knew that Charlie would be trying to summon her familiar from the moment class let out. She'd stayed up late the night before and had eaten breakfast outside while trying to do it. She would only be interested in the burglaries during class and would keep bugging him about it until he spilled everything he knew. It was also clear that Mr. Widdershins was too busy dealing with the students who had familiars to care about the ones without. Getting anyone to unsummon their animals was a hopeless battle for him, and he was spending the entire period breaking up fights and trying to silence a dozen animals that had invaded his classroom. Kuro gave in and started to relate what he knew. As he spoke, Arthur diligently noted everything down, just as Dubois had. Kuro realized what the hound had meant about not needing another informant. Arthur would happily pass on every scrap of information he gathered to his dad without a second thought. Kuro decided he'd have to be careful about what he shared. At the moment, though, he was pretty sure he didn't know anything Dubois wouldn't already have figured out. A thorough report from Arthur would ease any lingering suspicion that the hounds might have about Kuro's involvement. So he spilled everything he'd seen. Arthur asked probing questions, as a hound would, about the color of the carpet and the shape of the tears in the sheets, none of which Kuro could answer with confidence. Charlie asked questions Kuro was even less able to answer, like whether the room smelled like a poltergeist, and if the feathers could have belonged to a phoenix that exploded, causing all the damage. And Marie acted as though she wasn't interested by pretending to do the assigned reading. She exposed the fact that she wasn't really reading when Kuro brought up his idea of it being related to the summer air. "That doesn't make any sense," she said from behind her book, unable to keep out of the conversation. "Half the victims were girls."
"So what?" replied Charlie.
"Isn't Dier a boy?" asked Marie, her momentary confidence wavering.
"Nobody knows," Charlie said. "The baby hadn't been presented yet when the coup d'etat happened, and everybody who knew got killed. It's a huge mystery. They don't even know who the father was, or what the baby's name was going to be. All they really know is when the baby was born. During the coup, they found a changeling in the crib where the baby should be, but it changed into a monster and tried to run away."
"Yes, I know that part," said Marie. "That was Arthur. Arthur is a boy."
"Not really," said Arthur. "I'm a changeling."
"What?"
asked Marie, getting flustered. "I can be a girl if I want." As he said it, his figure and features shifted to look more like Marie. She cringed at the facsimile.
"I asked you not to do that."
"Sorry," said Arthur as he shifted back to his habitual, narrow, pale blonde appearance. "I wasn't thinking."
"But that means Dier could be anybody?" asked Marie.
"Not me," said Arthur. "I'm a changeling."
"Or me," said Kuro. "I was made by the people who started the coup."
"Me neither,"
added Charlie.
"I'm a half-elf and my birthday's in March."
"Why does that matter?" asked Marie.
"Because,"
Charlie drew out the word as though it were the most obvious thing in the world,
"the heir is from Tiernanog and was born in June."
"If I were going to hide a kid, the first thing I would do is lie about their birthday,"
Marie replied in a parody of Charlie's tone.
"And didn't you say they didn't know who the dad was? Why could it not be you?"
Charlie's eyes and mouth grew so wide that she might have been a changeling herself. She slid slowly off her chair into a graceless heap under her desk without seeming to notice and stayed there as she processed the shock. Having effectively incapacitated her roommate, Marie stopped pretending to work and joined the conversation properly. She stole Arthur's notes and started looking through them, tapping on the bridge of her glasses.
"It doesn't make sense, though." It's not like a secret hidden prince is going to bring a sign with them to school to say that they're the heir. If they had one, they'd leave it at home or in a box at the bottom of the ocean.
Kuro pouted. She was right, but he didn't like it. His theory had been so clever.
It makes a lot of sense that they're looking for something, though, she said, easing some of Kuro's disappointment. But we don't know what. Maybe we should think about who is doing it and how.
It has to be someone who can sneak into a residence undetected, said Arthur. Someone powerful and clever.
Not necessarily, said Kuro, earning some quizzical looks that demanded he explain himself.
Wizards all think that way, he said. They all put fancy enchantments on things to stop spells and stuff. But I never stole anything by being smart or doing fancy magic. The easiest way to steal something is to just walk up and take it. If you look like you belong there, nobody even questions it.
Who could get into a residence without raising suspicion? Asked Marie.
Almost anybody, said Arthur, showing her pages of potential burglars he'd compiled. Students can go into each other's residence as guests.
Then everyone on the island is a suspect?
Marie had been starting to get excited about their chances of solving the mystery, but Arthur had dampened her spirits.
Not everybody, said Arthur. Evelyn was burgled during Samhain, and everybody was there. Only people who could get down to the ground and back could do it, so it's only high school students.
Freya Mimirdottir's magpie familiar chose that moment to grab Charlie's pen cap off her desk, and a look of mutual understanding passed among the friends.
A familiar could do it, said Arthur, putting into words what had become obvious.
Kuro shook his head. Familiars can't get in or out. The residences all have salt brick lining. Familiars can't cross that. Just like fairies and ghosts in Luton.
He and Arthur deflated a bit at having yet another theory dashed. But Marie smirked and crossed her arms in smug satisfaction.
I think that makes even more sense. She let her friends wonder for a moment before relieving their curiosity.
Somebody goes into their residence and summons their familiar somewhere hidden. Then the familiar comes out and does the burglary when the owner has a good alibi. And then they come back and get it later when it's not suspicious. That's why these burglaries are so many days apart.
Arthur was so impressed that he quietly applauded her explanation.
You are very good at this, he said.
Marie shrugged. My parents watch a lot of detective shows. Charlie, having finally collected herself from the stunning revelation about her potential nobility, inserted herself into the conversation.
So how are we going to catch them? She demanded enthusiastically.
Don't be silly, said Marie, picking her textbook back up. That is for teachers and police.
The part of Kuro that was dangerously curious spent the rest of the day coming up with ways to search out the burglar. They could find out what each student's familiar was and eliminate, one by one, which ones could be responsible. They could guess at who the next target would be and take turns watching their room. They could search out hidden spaces in the other residences, looking for a familiar waiting for the perfect moment to strike. Or they could, as Marie suggested before heading out in search of bilious tree frogs that evening,
stop acting like children and get on with their schoolwork.
She was right, and Kuro didn't like it. He was just starting to get the hang of being a child, and now he had to stop it. Charlie and Arthur did not agree. Charlie scrawled out a chapter summary in under 10 minutes based on her loose understanding, then went outside to practice summoning her familiar. That was a bit of a relief. Since Marie's suggestion that she could possibly be the heir, she'd been insisting that they call her Your Majesty. Arthur decided to go with her, planning to summon familiars until he got a good one and not being concerned about getting work done on time. They didn't have to worry as much as Kuro. They worked faster, knew more, and probably wouldn't end up in prison if they failed. Kuro was left with his thoughts and his homework, neither of which he was interested in being alone with. Even more annoying was that when he sat down to do the reading he should have been doing in class, he found that it was interesting. He had been all prepared to complain about it being a complete waste of time. He tried to write a summary, but the pictures and stories in the book were too complicated to sum up. He would have to skip all the best details. He decided that it would be better to use his evening to explore the places the textbook talked about, rather than write about them. Before it housed a school, Kuro learned, Avalon Island had been fought over a lot because it was between all the territories and was so unusual, having seasons that never changed and an enormous stone spire in the middle. Every kingdom had held it at some point. There were all sorts of battles and assassinations and trials and marriages and betrayals. When the kingdoms made peace and formed a joint senate, they chose Avalon as the place to have their unified capital, the high school had been their parliament building, and the four residences had been their embassies. After a while, all the nobles got sick of taking boats through the Blandlands, so they moved everything to Bytown. They converted all the big buildings for use by the school, but they left other things behind that the textbook talked about. Kuro wandered out to the Stone of Oaths, where kings and queens of ages past had sworn vows to each other, a squarish block of limestone that sat on a cliff edge in the summer quarter. It was mossy and not easy to see among the untended weeds. The stone had looked much more impressive in the book, surrounded by people with crowns and swords. He jogged down to the amphitheater in the spring quarter, where the school now held assemblies for the students. It had once been a court where criminals were tried. He went behind the stage to where they had kept the accused locked up. There was a steel door barring his way, but he picked the lock and went exploring. A steep, narrow stairway led down to a cramped corridor containing four small windowless rooms with heavy metal doors. That was where Kuro would have been held if he had been caught by Dubois 100 years earlier. He might have been executed or had his hands chopped off back then. He let himself into some of the rooms, but they weren't very dramatic. They were just being used for storage. The rooms were full of servants' uniforms, pillows and bedding, cleaning and alchemy supplies, coffee makers and laundry machines. Much like the Stone of Oaths, it was underwhelming, a neglected and boring echo of something Kuro's book had made seem so historical. The last stop on his personal tour was much more satisfying. It was a mausoleum and a graveyard at the border between autumn and winter, where the founders of the Confederation were buried. It wasn't any more impressive than the previous two, but it felt more appropriate for a cemetery to be untended and overgrown. He climbed on top of the mausoleum and stared up at the stars, emerging in the darkening sky, until his thoughts came creeping back to him. The trip around the island had eased his gnawing curiosity for a while, but alone in the quiet at the edge of winter, those notions crept back in. The one that decided to take hold of him was the question of his familiar. Did he have one? Like Arthur, he had assumed that it was a human's only kind of thing, and it was so complicated that he'd never get it right even if he tried. But Arthur had one, and Kuro hadn't ever cast the spell. It couldn't hurt to try, he thought. Well, it could, actually. He considered all the spell attempts that had failed catastrophically for him. Nobody was around, though. He wouldn't be putting anyone but himself in danger. He decided to give it just one attempt. He did what the book had said and meditated on thoughts of home and family. Once he'd overcome the associated panic attack from memories of Phineas and Detritus Lane, he started the song and dance, but was interrupted.
"What are you doing?"
came a squeaky demand from right behind him. Kuro bolted like a startled chipmunk, clearing the cemetery in two bounds and then shooting up a tree. He scanned the graveyard and found a grouchy Luton looking back at him judgmentally, as though Kuro had been up to some villainy. The sight of the little Luton eased some of the panic, and Kuro let the air back into his lungs. "Hi, Bindle."
"What are you doing?"
he repeated, moving to the base of Kuro's tree in a blink. "I was trying to summon my familiar." Kuro hopped down, cushioning his fall with a burst of air. "But you surprised me."
"You will teach me that."
Bindle stood back and waited for Kuro to begin the lesson he'd just demanded.
"It's complicated," said Kuro. "I can't even do it myself."
"That is because you are very bad," Bindle explained. "Teach me now."
"It's in Gaelic," argued Kuro.
Bindle was insulted at the suggestion that he wouldn't understand.
"I know wizard words."
"I really don't think I'm going to be able to teach you," said Kuro.
"You promised,"
was Bindle's only reply.
"Yeah, but I'd just waste your time. I'm no good at it. I could bring my friend Arthur. He can do it. He'd probably help."
"No,"
snapped Bindle.
"You teach me."
Kuro relented. He couldn't see the harm in it. Bindle usually got bored and left pretty quickly anyway. But the Luton, who had always vanished at the first diagram in the dirt or thread of theory, kept demanding that Kuro explain again and better. Neither of them could get anything productive to happen. Kuro could occasionally stir up a bit of a dust storm, which could be mistaken for the start of a summoning, but they were nowhere near conjuring something. After 3 hours of explanations, demonstrations, and abject failure, Kuro was exhausted. He let his head fall backwards and groaned. He was cold and tired and just wanted to go to bed.
"Just let me come back tomorrow with someone who can actually teach you."
"No,"
Bindle shrieked.
"No wizards, only you."
His reaction was not like the normal overconfident demands the tiny Luton made. It was more of panic.
"Why?"
"No wizards, only you," said Bindle. "It is a promise."
but I am a wizard.
The Kuro monster is not a wizard. The Kuro monster is a monster.
Bindle was impatient having to explain something so obvious. Kuro regretted asking. It hurt all the more because it was true.
Okay,
he said, building some determination.
I'll teach you, but I have to get better. I need practice. How can I find you when I'm ready?
You can't,
said Bindle, and then he vanished.
Thank you for listening to Stealing from Wizards. If you liked our show, please consider rating or reviewing on iTunes. If you want to support this podcast or just can't wait for the next chapter, the full book is available on Amazon, Kobo, and Indigo. Our theme music was written by Camille Saint-Saëns, transcribed by Franz Liszt, performed by Rebecca Verdun, and used with permission. This episode was produced by Jim Tigwell.